What happens when a political party falls out of love with the people that it's supposed to represent? Because it's been happening in the US for 30 years. The Democrats have been chasing the votes of wealthier, well-educated professionals. But who's left behind or even pushed out of the party? I mean, if you're a 30-something web designer on 200 grand a year with liberal views on sex and immigration, your interests probably don't coincide that much with those of a 40-something woman who works in a nursing home, 13 bucks an hour, and then tries to keep something to put in the plate on Sunday mornings. So can any party be big enough for both? Because this is also a debate and a question for the Labor Party in Australia and the UK. The University of California law professor and Democratic Party activist Joan Williams has wrestled with this question in a much-praised new book, White Working Class: Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. And Joan Williams joins us. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Joan. Why this book and why now?
I wrote it because Trump won. It was strictly a way of blocking pain. I wrote it in 7 weeks after the election. Trump's victory was profoundly shocking to many, many Americans. And I had written, actually, some years ago, an academic book that described what I called the class culture gap between what's often called the white working class, the really middle America, and the professional managerial elite. And when I wrote that, I went around on book tour and gave a talk at Harvard that was sponsored by a high-level Democrat. And she said, you know, you're saying exactly what the Democratic Party needs to hear, and they will never listen to you.
When you say, though, Joan, what the Democratic Party needs to hear, did they want to hear it? That's the point, because we've just had months now of this debate about identity politics with the Hillary Clinton and the sort of corporate establishment Democrats clinging to identity politics. And you've got Bernie Sanders people saying, no, let's get serious about class. Did they want to hear it?
Well, you know, I have a kind of a different take on this. I come out of identity politics, and I don't think I'm arguing against identity politics. I think I'm just arguing to add an additional identity, which is by social class. I think that one of the problems in the Democratic Party is that the debate has been framed as a debate between identity politics on the one hand and taking the white working class seriously on the other. I think that it's pretty irritating for women and people of color to hear, well, we've been talking about your issues for 40 years, but now we're moving on to something like class. But what I think people need to recognize is that if you focus on basically every important differential of social power other than social class, and you talk about sexual orientation, and you talk about gender, and you talk about everything else, and you make believe like class doesn't exist, class comes back to bite you. And that's what's happening.
Well, Joan, in the US, I wonder if it's the same as in Australia, where the upper middle class, or what you call the professional managerial class, is happy to talk a lot about racism and sexism, but they go all silent when it comes to talking about class. I mean, is it the same situation that we have here?
I think it's very similar in all of the Anglo-American countries. The book has received a wide reception in many, many different areas, being translated into Japanese, for example. I've received a lot of feedback that it describes a dynamic that is going on in many countries, Israel, for example. And I think that what has happened is that the professional managerial elite, as I call them, the PME, they think of themselves as having earned everything they own, and they don't have class privilege. They're just smarter than all the rest of them. You know, that's a comfy thing to think. But from the point of view of the white working class, and in fact, all non-elites, they look at the professional and managerial elite, and they go like, these people were born on third base, and they think they hit a triple, which is a baseball metaphor, which means you think you really hit an amazingly strong ball when, in fact, you were born with privilege.
Yeah.
And the ideology, particularly in Anglo-American countries, but also, I mean, I was living in the Netherlands in the spring, is that the PME likes to think of themselves as having earned everything that they have. And of course, at some level, they have. They've worked very hard. But as I try to point out to people, so do hotel housekeepers, and so do laid off factory workers. They've worked very hard too. So I think that it's awkward and uncomfortable for the professional managerial elite to say, you know what, we've been systematically advantaged by class privilege, but I think they've seen what happens when they refuse to acknowledge that. Yeah.
We should very briefly just clarify those terms, because the professional managerial elite that you refer to, that we might call the upper middle class here in Australia, we're not talking here about the sort of super rich, the top 10th of 1%. They're in a sort of a category of their own. We're talking here about what, about 10% or 20% of the American population.
Yeah, in the US, they call themselves upper middle class too. That's a way of ignoring the fact they're an elite. I define them as roughly the top 15 to 20% of Americans. And for example, one of the things I often do in talks is start out by asking people to raise their hands if they think they're part of the middle class. And then I point out to them that if they have a household income of $200,000 or more, they're in the top 6% of Americans. Often they can't believe it. Mm. They cannot believe that. They cannot believe that two-thirds of Americans lack college degrees. When I first began to talk about this book, people did not believe either of those facts. Now they're widely discussed.
So, Joan, how did these two groups, the professional managerial elite and the very broad working class, that is, people in sort of, you know, lower white-collar occupations and what's left of the once great blue-collar industries, how did these two groups come to, well, not just be suspicious of each other, but in some sense, loathe each other?
No, it's true. I define the working class as like the middle 53%. This is really the middle class. And you're right, there are really hard feelings between the broad middle, that middle 50%, and the top 15 to 20%, the professional managerial elite. And there are, because they have different patterns of food, friendship, child-rearing, work, virtually everything. There's a real culture gap between these two groups. The professional managerial elite, for example, they have broad and shallow, what are called entrepreneurial networks. You go to college and you have a national or global network immediately. The middle class doesn't have that kind of broad, shallow network. They tend to have dense clique networks where they know the same group of people often for their whole lives. They have very deep ties with a very limited number of people. And so, for example, that's one of the reasons why people in that middle class are reluctant often to go away to college. Mm. Their parents expect them to be part of the same clique network for their entire lives. And that's certainly not true of people in the college-educated elite. The college-educated elite values edginess, they value sophistication, they value artisanal everything from coffee to spirituality. Whereas in the middle class, the achievement of settled middle-class life requires self-discipline. It requires the self-discipline, for example, to go to a not very glorious and often not wildly well-paid job on time every day for 40 years straight. And so the central ethic of the middle class is self-discipline, whereas the central ethic of the elite is self-development.
Yeah.
We like develop our children, we develop ourselves.
Yeah.
That's not available to people in the middle class. They like the tried and true.
When you talk there, Joan, about these different expectations of life and the different lifestyles of that broad middle class versus the upper middle class, there's a snobbery, though, too, isn't there? Because effectively, this upper middle class looks down often on those values of connectedness and rootedness in local communities because, you know, they style themselves as cosmopolitans. We can be anywhere. We've got a credential that's our passport to the world.
Yes, they do. There's a lot of sneering. There's a lot of the sense that the middle class is unsophisticated, they're parochial, whereas we, the elite, are citizens of the world and so broad-minded. And in fact, the cosmopolitanism that the elite often prides itself on. In the United States, the feeling rules are that you should really feel very emotionally tied up with immigrants. But blue collar people in your own country, oh, they're just kind of dim-witted. And the broad middle classes in the United States think this is a shocking lack of solidarity. Why should the elite in the United States care more about people in other countries than people in their own country who are struggling? So what's a point of pride and honor for the elite to be citizens of the world is seen by blue-collar folks and people in modest white-collar jobs as a callousness towards fellow citizens.
Yeah. We should talk about this because this is where the upper middle class loves to talk about. And frankly, as I read your book, they love to talk down to the working class, and that is on race. So let's confront this, Joan. Is the working class racist?
Yes, they are. And so is the elite. There's plenty of blame for racism to go around. And I think it's very important, particularly in the United States. I mean, we have a president who's encouraging white supremacy. So that's just shocking beyond belief. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the United States and elsewhere on racism. That said, there's also often an extremely unhelpful and unpleasant dynamic where elites displace blame for racism onto whites of a lower class than they are. Mm. I call this using anti-racism as an excuse for snobbery. You know what? That doesn't help racism. That actually feeds racism. Yeah. So I think that we all need to work on racism in other people and, very importantly, in ourselves. But just writing off the white working class as beneath our notice because those other whites are racist, I don't think it helps people of color. I don't think it helps anti-racism. I think it hurts people of color and it hurts anti-racism because it uses anti-racism as an excuse for non-reflective snobbery.
Yeah. I mean, you make this point very powerfully, that working class people, they're being directed, they're being instructed to feel sorry for certain undoubtedly disadvantaged groups. But the instructions are coming from people who very rarely give up or make a sacrifice for their own principles, do they?
Well, you know, it's what sociologists call feeling rules, who you're supposed to feel sorry for, who you're supposed to feel personally responsible for. And in the United States, among the progressive elite, you're definitely supposed to feel sorry for immigrants and feel that it's an ethical obligation for you to help immigrants. But you're not necessarily supposed to feel sorry for blue-collar people who have been displaced by globalization. You know, the economy, creative disruption, that's creative disruption. And so you have this empathetic human rights frame being used when immigrants are being considered. And you have this kind of heartless neoliberal frame when fellow Americans of a different class are being considered. You know, what's the logical next step? You have the fellow Americans being extremely resentful of immigrants. Again, I don't condone racism. I just think that people in my crowd should stop fueling it.
Let's deal also with this question about class and sexism. Why did the working class, including working class women, simply shrug their shoulders every time Hillary Clinton talked about smashing through the glass ceiling if she were to become president?
Well, you know, bless her heart. I voted for Hillary Clinton. I worked hard for her. But she is a classic example of what I call class cluelessness. I mean, if you think about the glass ceiling, what does that metaphor say? It says that privileged women should be able to get the kinds of jobs that privileged men have traditionally had. Why should the middle classes care? They do not care. To them, that sounds like privileged white women claiming class privilege. It's not, they're not interested. And so there are other feminist issues that are not so localized in class interests. For example, sexual harassment. So if after the Access Hollywood tapes where Trump bragged about grabbing women in their private parts, if the Clinton campaign had said, look, sexual harassment is a scourge for many, many women, women in pink collar jobs, women in low wage jobs, especially women in blue collar jobs, they're sexually harassed all the time. And this has to stop. I think she would have had more of a shot at making gender into something that could work for her to attract women's votes.
Joan Williams is the author of the critically acclaimed new book, White Working Class Overcoming Class Cluelessness. Joan, thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the invitation.